Welcome to Ear to the Pavement. I'm Allison Lierish-Dean. This is the first episode in a new series I'll be doing about the American South, in which I'll cover a range of political and historical topics through a Southern lens. On this inaugural show in the series, I talk with Professor Adolph Reed about his new book, The South, Jim Crow and Its Afterlives, published in 2022 by Verso. Adolph Reed is well known for his analyses of class and racial politics under neoliberalism and of black political figures such as Malcolm X, Jesse Jackson, and Barack Obama. In his book, The South, Reed speaks as a member of the last generation with a living memory of the Jim Crow order. He's concerned that as Jim Crow recedes into history, our understanding of it is becoming caricatured. Increasingly, our notions of what Jim Crow was are gleaned from just a few dramatic symbols and representations. But it was the ordinary stuff of everyday life, Reed argues, that held the Jim Crow system together. His book shows this by weaving together his own personal stories of growing up under the regime with his signature political analysis. Adolph Reed Jr. is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also taught at Howard, Yale, Northwestern, the University of Illinois at Chicago, and the New School. Reed has been a columnist for The Progressive, The Village Voice, and The New Republic, and frequently writes for The Nation, Dissent, and Nonsite.org. He's an organizer in the Debs Jones Douglas Institute's Medicare for All South Carolina campaign and is a regular on the Class Matters podcast. And now to my conversation with Adolph Reed. The book is filled with these wonderful and often frightening, painful, and sometimes humorous stories about your experiences in the South, going back to childhood in New Orleans. And I'm really interested in how you're using your personal memories and stories in this book in service of getting at a larger historical truth about the Jim Crow era. Because the book struck me as kind of a hybrid between memoir and historical analysis. But I also think that using personal experiences can be kind of tricky when you're also trying to maintain like a political perspective.
Right.
And I have read quite a bit of your past writing, and I don't recall you ever doing this before, using personal experience. And so I was wondering if that impulse to write publicly about personal experiences is new to you, and just how you navigated that decision to include these stories and memories in this book.
Well, yeah, that's a really interesting question. The first response to the how I came to do it, part of the question is really under duress. Well, I'm going to back up a second just to affirm your other perception. Like when I was writing a regular column in the Village Voice, Karen Durbin was my editor. And I wrote a column on the chatter about what did they call it? The shortage of statistically appropriate black men for middle-class black women, basically. It was called by some other shorthand. I don't recall the shorthand now, but I wrote this column sparked by the Waiting to Exhale film and book, and also by a couple of interactions with a friend who was contemplating trying to set me up, with somebody. But when I submitted the draft to Karen, she said to me, "I never imagined that it would be possible that someone could write a column on this topic and not have an iota of themselves in it anywhere." And then she said, "But once I thought about it, I figured that if anybody in the world could do it, it would be you." I've always scrupulously avoided this kind of stuff. And what happened with the book actually I'm sure you've read or maybe heard me say elsewhere too that I started writing it like in the early 2000s with no particular objective in sight. And I wrote myself into like the 15,000 word range, which was deadly. The first 2/3 of that draft was straight historicizing narrative. And the last third was a series of vignettes that I just tacked tacked together at the end of the narrative that were drawn from incidents in my personal experience that I used to comment on broader phenomena. There wasn't anywhere near as much, even in some of the instances or some of the portions of the book that are directly built on those vignettes. Mm-hmm. There's probably more personal stuff in the stories now than there was when I originally wrote them. Mm-hmm. And what happened was after Barbara Fields read the draft, which I'd sat on with intermittent attempts to try to publish here and there for several years, close to a decade, I think. Mm-hmm. She put me in touch with an editor friend of hers who actually lived around the corner from me in New Haven, but I didn't know her then, who thought that it would be helpful to make it more of a memoir, which I resisted, of course. I didn't really want to do that. Mm-hmm. And then finally, I asked my former agent, Faith Childs in Manhattan, to take a look at it, and she got back to me. She was also enthusiastic, but she got back to me with about a dozen to 15 specific points, which is really how the book got finished, because I probably wouldn't have been able to do it otherwise. Mm-hmm. And made some suggestions about portions of the book that she thought could be improved by having, by situating myself in and my family or personal history. In relation to it a little bit more. So mm-hmm. It's not the kind of thing that I like to do. It's not my first choice in doing things. And that's why I've mightily resisted classifying this as a memoir, because I've never seen it as a memoir.
Right. Right.
And at one point, somebody who was in charge of writing catalog copy for Verso, did so, it seemed to me, without having read the book or like having read the book in a pro forma way, mm-hmm. What described it as a combination of memoir, travelogue, and coming of age story. And I found out about this because a friend of mine sent me a link to the copy from Amazon. Mm-hmm. And I wrote my agent, who's a good friend, and everybody else I can think of, and told them, look, like, I would rather let the book die on my fucking laptop than have it go out in the world, let them like this. So we got it all straight. So that's kind of a long-winded answer to how I came to do it, but I think it's an effective one, though.
Yeah. Well, I was wondering, because I often have the opposite impulse, which is I've done a bit of writing recently about, I would guess I would say, political topics. Mm-hmm. But often, very often, my initial impulse comes from, or my initial starting place is a personal experience. And there's uh-huh. this desire to kind of work out from that and somehow right. kind of situate that in some sort of larger political economy, or to sort of figure out how it fits into that larger picture. Mm-hmm. And I understand what's problematic or dangerous about that, especially if you're trying to make sure that you infuse your writing with a certain politics, right? But mm-hmm. at the same time, I've always been kind of uncomfortable with that impulse in myself, but yet also there's sort of an irresistibleness to it. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like in the course of writing this book, or even before you started writing it, did you have some sort of theory about using personal experiences as a historical writer, or as a writer who's really involved in a certain politics?
I don't know if it rises to the level of a theory, though it may. I mean, like what I know, like I've known several things. One is that I've not ever wanted to be a personality, if you know what I mean, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I've never wanted to have my politics connected to a story about who I am or the kind of person that I am, right?
Right. Right.
And that goes back, frankly, that goes back to the late 60s, right? And and like different strains and tendencies within the New Left, right? I mean, the slogan, the personal, the slogan, the personal is political, made it what was a very powerful in that moment of the emergence of the second wave of the women's movement, and and what it, and the point that it made about the role of the domestic realm in the reproduction of capitalist hierarchy, basically. But it also went very, very quickly to the kind of libertinage, but associated with hippies. And I'll be honest, I never liked hippies, right? I mean, not even when we were all supposed to be on the same side.
Right.
And I mean, part of that, frankly, I suspect, because I have other friends and long-term comrades who are like this too, I suspect some of it may have to do with having had a certain kind of Catholic upbringing, right? But I've also, I also understand the last 25 or 30 years or more now at this point, I guess, with the emergence of the notion of the public intellectual and all that kind of stuff. I think my impulses kind of push in the opposite direction, that I'm not that important, right? I'm nothing special.
Right.
And what we need to be focused on, like, I want to be a cog in the movement, right? And that's right. How I think everybody ought to approach it.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Yeah, I think for me that—
And by everybody, I mean everybody who is in it, like, as a, professional agitator, basically.
Right, it's sort of the opposite of kind of the Cornel West idea.
Yeah, I mean, we're friends and we're comrades. Like, we had our issues years and years ago, but like, so we toured a lot together during the two Sanders campaigns. And he's been very gracious, almost embarrassingly so, toward and about me. But yeah, so I've come to appreciate the thing that he does. And when we are in tandem, it's almost like a Mr. Inside, Mr. Outside thing. In fact, it's funny, like on Katie Helper's podcast a couple of weeks ago, some kid asked me about why I don't, more publicly make moral pronouncements about the failings of foreign the regimes that the U.S. Doesn't support, and raised Cornell as an alternative. And I said, well, Cornell does what he does, and I appreciate it and respect it. But yeah, I don't see the what people understand to be the public realm, which to me, frankly, is the, larger corporate newsfotainment industry, basically, as the domain where I do my politics, right? So
right. Right. Yep. Yes. Whereas he does actually use that domain quite a lot.
And that's fine. Yeah. And that's fine for people to do it. Well, but I'll say also that, and this is one of the most gratifying personal experiences for me, that in my perspective, like, all of the, kind of public writing, right, the columns and stuff that I do is really directed toward communicating with people who either haven't quite figured out exactly what they think, haven't quite figured out exactly how to navigate the different strains of discourse on what I've taken to referring to as whatever this thing is that occupies the cultural space that a left would occupy if there were one, right? Like in the U.S. And also to identify people. So I feel really gratified when random people whom I don't know will email me and help them put together something that they hadn't quite been able to formulate, or even to embolden them to say out loud things they'd been thinking. Right. And
Right. No, right? I get
and,
that.
And I mean, yeah, to me, that's all part of an organizing project. So I try to stay in touch with people like that, mm-hmm, and connect them with other people. And that's kind of the spirit that our new podcast grew out of too, as an extension of the small group worker trainings on the economy and in a healthcare crisis, like another stuff that we do.
Right. What's the name of the podcast?
Class Matters Podcast.
Yeah. No, good to mention it so that people listening can also check that out. Yeah. No, that's good. So I wanted to move on to this theme that runs throughout the book, albeit not necessarily explicitly, but this idea of the insider-outsider, mm-hmm, which I find really interesting because I can really identify with that.
Yeah, I understand.
I grew up in Charleston, South Carolina, in the 1970s and 80s. And then was sent away to boarding school at a pretty young age when I was about 12 years old, and lived in Vermont and Maryland and all these different places. And so I felt like I kind of left the South sometime in the mid 80s, mm-hmm, or so, and did not live there continuously until actually a couple of, mm-hmm, months ago when I moved back to the South after, I don't know, 30 something years, after living in Boston and New York and London and Oregon and, lots of different places. And so I'm now in North Carolina, and I'm reading your book completely coincidentally at a time when I'm also really super aware of this insider outsider, mm-hmm, feeling, because I've come back to the South. And so I wanted to ask you about that insider outsider perspective and ask you, in what way do you see yourself as an insider, and in what way are you an outsider to the South, and how did this insider outsider position that you occupy shape your experience of writing the book and how you talk about the Jim Crow regime in the book?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I think one way that it shaped it is, and I think I mentioned this in the book too, that is that, from childhood, the experience of going back and forth, like, into and out of the region, just kind of defamiliarized the Jim Crow world as a, natural order, right? Because I had to keep getting instructions on the rules. And while I was too young to understand for much of that time, I was too young to understand exactly what the rules were about. I just mentioned, like, in a Jacobin interview that somebody had asked me, there's an incident I mentioned early in the book when I was riding the ferry across the Mississippi River with my grandmother, and I noticed, mm-hmm, that the seating area was cut in half by chicken wire. And I asked her what was up with the chicken wire, basically. And she said to me, because we were sitting really close to it, she said to me in a stage whisper that, well, a lot of crazy people ride the ferry and they have to sit on the other side of the chicken wire. And somebody asked me about that not that long ago and asked whether, mm-hmm, whether it registered with me that all the people on the other side of the wire were white. And the reality is it didn't register, right? I'm with me. And there are a number of reasons that it didn't, or I suspect that it didn't. But one of them that I've reflected on is that part of learning the protocols is learning to make the racial distinction a very fundamental one in how one perceives what the life world around oneself, right? But I think another experience was kind of moving around a fair amount. Like in the mid 90s, when my friend Ken Warren and I were sort of noticing that we were in the center of a tendency, cabal, right? A group of Black scholars who were kind of sort of expressly anti anti-essentialist, right? Like in their work and thinking. Mm-hmm. That it occurred to us just chatting in a bar one night that one thing that all those people had in common was that they grew up either as a military brats or as academic brats. So they moved around a lot, right? Mm-hmm. And that experience kind of just predisposes you to understanding that things aren't the same everywhere. Black people aren't the same everywhere. So there's no such thing as a particular way of being black. But also, like among the older ones, that racial etiquette, was not the same right everywhere under Jim Crow. And I think also, I mean, like I see the flip side. I think a bit.
Meaning, sorry, let me just make sure. So, what you just said, meaning that depending on where you were in the South, the rules of etiquette could really vary.
Right, exactly.
A lot. That's a big point that you make in the book, that some of the stories really illustrate that. Mm-hmm. And how you almost have to learn the rules. You almost have to learn the rules in some ways.
Yeah, like wherever you were. And I mean, the stakes of not learning them were also kind of stressful because the nature of the order was that you always assumed to know. Right? I mean, But there's no real space or very little space for a simple mistake that transgressed local etiquette. For one illustration, the way that segregation in public transit had been conducted in Montgomery in Alabama right before the bus boycott, what was it? Blacks boarded the bus, on the front, paid, got off, and then reboarded through the rear door. And one of the indignities was that often enough, bus drivers would take the black person's money and then take off before they boarded in the rear. And it's like gratuitous, right? And one of the initial demands of the Montgomery Improvement Association was to stop that practice, right? So what they wanted was less gratuitously inhumane conduct of the Jim Crow rules, basically. But it's a whole lot of stuff like that varied from here to there. So I mean, all that I think contributed to it, and then I think there were other kind of idiosyncratic factors. I always felt kind of at home at the Northeast. In the Northeast, even when I wasn't living here. So I think I say this in the book too, that when I moved out of the South, back to this region, at the beginning of the Reagan administration, it also felt a little bit like coming back home.
Going back to the Northeast. Right. Because you lived there when you were younger, or you went, okay, that, I mean, that whole issue of kind of the ambiguities in the system, in the Jim Crow system, what really struck me was that the terror of the system wasn't that it was this kind of rigid system that sort of operated in a very kind of uniform way, but that it did have these idiosyncrasies, so you could never really kind of tell like whether you were doing the right thing or doing the thing that was going to, get you killed or get you, into a dangerous situation. And that, that persisted. You talk about how as the regime fell, and I think the foreword by Barbara Field, it's Barbara, Karen.
Yeah.
She talks about, she has this sentence in the foreword that regimes like Jim Crow are their most dangerous when they're in the process of dissolving. Mm-hmm. And, which I thought was really stuck with me. And the example of that, of course, is when you are in an airport in Arkansas, I believe, and you it's post Jim Crow. I mean, Jim Crow is officially, you know, it's been dismantled post 1965. And you find yourself at this airport that's kind of empty. And you know that even though Jim Crow is not, you know, kind of legal anymore, you're not sure, you still know that there can be consequences for breaking the rules. And so there are these two doorways and you're not sure which one as a colored person or as a black person you should go into. And so you just kind of wait outside, which is just a really powerful story because it's just not worth the risk.
Well, yeah, right. And I mean, look at it. If it had been someplace else like Memphis or maybe even Little Rock, right? But like this was El Dorado, Arkansas, right? And and nobody knew I was there, really. And it's very likely that nothing would have happened, but it wasn't you know, likely to the extent that it was impossible that something would happen. So it just made sense for me to sit out there in the cool breeze, chilly breeze, frankly, as I recall, and try to read till my plane came.
Right. I have kind of a slightly parenthetical question that I wasn't planning on asking, but I'm kind of curious about this because a lot of the book, there are a lot of stories in there about how you perceived the Jim Crow system as a child. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've watched my own children read books about race and about the civil rights movement and about Jim Crow. And, you know, there are like lots of children's books about race now and about racism in America. And I have often wondered what they're getting from those texts, like, because it seems to me that they don't yet have this idea of race that we as adults have. Right. And I'm curious, given your experience as a child, actually having to navigate that system, do you have thoughts on kind of how race is taught to
children? Oh, yeah, I do, actually. Yep, I have them, right? I mean, both from you know, foggy recollections of my own childhood, but also from being a teacher and a parent.
Right, of course.
So my son is, I think, around your age, right? Like, he'll be 52 in June.
Yep, I'm 52. Oh, okay. I turned 52 in September, wow, okay. So we're the same age. Yeah, like exactly the same age.
So
pretty much.
So when he was like 7, 8, 9, I would read him to sleep at night, basically. Mm-hmm. And I read him stuff like Kipling, which always made my father scratch his head, but also stuff like Huck Finn, right? And it would take a while to get through. You know, the books, because there was a lot of pausing to explain stuff, right? To overcome a sense of anachronism, to provide context about Missouri and the slave trade and so forth and so on, and uses of what is now known as the N-word and all that, trying to historicize it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think he was probably in about sixth grade. His teacher asked me to be the Black History Month speaker for their class. And my approach to this stuff is kind of always the same.
And this is in what state were you in Pennsylvania?
Oh, no, actually, that was in Atlanta.
Atlanta, right. Okay.
But as a rule, like, the way that I try to do this stuff is to start from the really concrete, right? What I mean, for instance, with my son, the fall of Saigon came just before his fifth birthday. So, I mean, naturally, we had talked about the Vietnam War and what was going on there. I think that the objective is to try to find ways or find to connect with the understandings or sense of experiences that kids can wrap their arms around, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, and this may, what I mean, you may find this horribly propagandistic and tendentious, but about Vietnam, the way I tried to explain it to him was, all right, like, you can imagine that you're in your house, and then one day these people show up and they're trying to put you out of your house, right? But as I recall from the Black History Month talk that the kids seemed to love, I talked about slavery, but not as the kind of oppression porn that people talk about it as now, right. But fundamentally as a labor relation, right? But I mean, not that abstract either, right? I mean, because kids don't understand, you know, a labor relation as an abstraction. But so my objective is always to go for the concrete characterizations, and then not to, you know, not to do what the heavy-handed moral instruction that runs a risk of telling kids more forcefully how they should think about something, right? Than to get them to understand it. Now, what one of my former advisees at Penn, who was also a former Tar Heel, said that when her son was a baby, she and her husband first wanted to instill in him that he hated Duke. And then once he understood that he hated Duke, the next stage in his moral development was to explain to him why he hated Duke. Right. So I didn't go quite that far, but there seems to me that what you want to do is to equip the kids with the tools to make the moral judgments, and that they should come from sort of concrete understanding. Now I'll admit that that there were two sensations that are working in the background of that. One, you know, one is I'm an escapee from 12 years of Catholic school, which didn't ever quite take that approach, but I can, but I can sniff the Baltimore Catechism from the way that the bear can sniff a salmon from a mile and a half away. And the other thing is
I kind of think all kids sort of almost have like a built-in mechanism for that, even if they haven't been exposed to it in the way that you would be at Catholic school.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah. I think that's right. I think it's absolutely right. And I mean, the other thing is that so when I was a small kid, I was really I was really into Aesop's fables. And one of my favorites was a fable about the contest between the sun and the wind, about which was stronger. Mm-hmm. And the way it went was, they decided to settle the bet or the disagreement when they saw a fellow walking down the road with a jacket loosely on his shoulders. Mm-hmm. And the objective was to see which one could get it off him. And the wind blew and blew and blew and blew. And the harder it blew, the more tightly the guy gripped the jacket around him. So the wind exhausted itself. And then the sun just gradually began to radiate heat. And the guy took off the jacket himself. And that's been my entire approach to organizing, like in every domain.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great one. I want to move on to talk about one of the big big themes of the book. I felt like was this question of how we consume civil rights imagery today. You talk in the book about how a lot of the images we see of the civil rights era South, you know, the lunch counter photos, the segregationist signage, separate water fountains, separate movie theaters, et cetera, actually have the effect of kind of flattening and even undermining our understanding of the experience of Jim Crow society as a coherent social order. Can you talk about how this works? Why are these sorts of images perhaps insufficient for fully understanding what this era of Southern society was like.
Right. Yeah. Well, yep. It's another really good question. Let me start with like a kind of funny anecdote from the present, actually. Okay. So in 2019, I went on a campus tour in North Carolina and South Carolina with the Sanders campaign. Right. Mm-hmm. And when we got to Greensboro, one of the items on our agenda was a tour of the Civil Rights Museum downtown, which I think was in the site of the old Woolworths building.
It is. That's actually where I am. I'm in
Greensboro. Oh, yeah, that's right. Right. Well.
Yeah, I don't know. I just moved here, so I'm still getting to know it. But yes, I've been down there and seen it. And I've actually never been in the museum because COVID's been so bad here until just recently. But yeah,
well,
that's exactly.
Well, so when we got in and, you know, I was with Bernie and Cornell and Nina Turner let me turn this off.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. No worries.
Danny Glover, Robert, and a few other people. And, and when we were going through the museum, like everyone was like quite moved. Right. And was emotional about it, you know, with that kind of, I can't believe this. This is so horrible. And the preserved Woolworths lunch counter is there. And I felt really weird and tawdry because, among other things, you know, not only had I eaten at that lunch counter when it was a lunch counter, now it was well after 1960, of course. But there's a way that the
you ate at that when it was a lunch counter, you said after night. When did you eat at it?
It must have been 66, 67, right?
Okay.
Because actually one of the first things that I did in a college in Chapel Hill was Cone Mills was in the middle of an organizing drive, maybe a strike even. The union ran buses over from Chapel Hill and Durham for college students to walk the picket line over there, which is how I first encountered the North Carolina Klan, but I also worked in Greensboro later after I was out of school. But it wasn't just the lunch counter, but it was like I just wasn't capable of the kind of intense emotional reaction to the entire museum, right? Or to all of the exhibits that everyone else was there. And then it occurred to me that, well, you know, Nina's from Ohio and Danny's from Oakland, Cornell was from Sacramento. Danny and I are the same age and our political histories overlapped a lot. But Nina and Cornell are actually younger. And so I can understand it, but in a way it left me almost with a dirty or an unwholesome feeling that I wasn't it's like the experience like in the Pentecostal church when everyone around you is getting saved and having the altar call, but you just don't quite feel it. Right.
Right. Right. Right.
Mm-hmm. But that said, I think the big problem has to do less with how we understand or how we're encouraged to understand the South than with how we're encouraged to perceive the world, past and present, when all around us, like in general, right? I think it's what Adorno described once as the domination of the concept over its object, right? I mentioned it someplace too, like a little while after my father died in Fayetteville, Arkansas, like I was still there going through his stuff. And I'd been there for several weeks and I wanted to take a break to go see a movie or something. And with some good friends of mine there who are still good friends of mine, I noticed that Cold Mountain was playing in the theater downtown and it seemed like the only thing that wasn't a pure kids movie. So in preparing to see it, I read, I came across an article by Manola Dargis when she was still, still at the LA Times. It was partly on period films. And she made the point that the only people now who who pay attention to historical detail in period movies are the props people and the costume designers. So that you get what with the restoration hardware version of 1860 door handles. But like all of the sensibilities, all of the self-perceptions, all the dialogue, right, but more than the dialogue, the underlying ontological understanding of the world is presentist, right?
Right.
So that's the overarching problem. But within that, about the Jim Crow era and the civil rights movement in particular, like it's easy to understand how the heroic narrative, right, kind of washes over everything else, right? So in fact, this guy named Jason Sokol, who's an historian, who just did what was overall a positive review of my book in the Washington Post, said he was curious about why I didn't say more about the impact of the 1960-61 school desegregation crisis in New Orleans on me, and in particular the heroic figure of Ruby Bridges, who was one of the kids who desegregated the school. So I wrote him. I said, "Well, I was aware of it, and I treated that in the book like I treat every other big event, right, as a backdrop against which or in relation to which I'd like to understand the quotidian facets of life under the regime, right? But it's understandable that people are so moved by the big stuff, right? The big good stuff, like the bravery of like the everyday people, right? Like the grandfather of Emmett Till, and also the big horrible stuff, right? But the problem is, and this is partly what the impulse to write the book was about, that as time goes on and as everyday realities of the regime and the mechanisms through which it's reproduced on a daily basis slip farther and farther away from consciousness, then the big stuff becomes the whole thing, and you get a cartoonish understanding of where the order came from, what it was, and for that matter, even how it was transformed and defeated.
Right. And so going back to that story you told about being in the museum, the Woolworth Counter Museum in Greensboro, how would you answer that question of you didn't have that emotional reaction if someone were to ask you why? How would you answer that?
I guess I would say, well, it's just too familiar. So like this connects with something else actually, right? And that's related.
I mean, maybe the question is, why were they having
I mean, I agree. That might be right.
You know,
That's a very good point. Because it's very, or that phenomenon, right, is very much of a piece to me with something else that I've noticed among friends, colleagues, class peers that doesn't really have to do with race, but it's a tendency, and I'm sure that you've heard it a gazillion times in your life already. But the tendency to hyper valorize the strength, bravery, beauty, and the resilience, which is like a neoliberal word I hate at this point, or a word that's been taken up by neoliberal ideology
of poor
struggling people, and this is something that pops up a lot, but like in organizing too, like the organizing school that it's all about having people tell their stories, but the account of the woman who has to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and get her kids together and take 3 buses to get to work at Walmart or whatever, and then get back and can't afford the healthcare. And there's a kind of liberal the reaction to it that both marvels at how people overcome all these obstacles or live with all these obstacles,
right.
And asks, you know, or well, and it marvels also at like how, you know, how they're able to do it. And mm-hmm. my reaction, which of course I never share with anybody because I'm that kind of rude person. But, but I mean, my reaction is always, well, that's what most of the world does every fucking day.
Right. Right. Exactly.
So mm-hmm. it might seem special to you, but it's not special to them. And it's not special to them because they are preternaturally brave. It's because mm-hmm. that's what life is, right? So mm-hmm. when, mm-hmm. so yeah, like the indignity of being, you know, turned away from what you thought was the Jim Crow window, I guess, mm-hmm. would seem, and we also in America now, especially in our class, therapize every damn thing and like tend to reduce everything to the psychological, which I think is another
right.
reason that people have, you know, difficulty of locating the Jim Crow era properly, right? Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, as an historical phenomenon, I just had a back and forth with a nationalist guy about a week ago about this, because his thing is, well, you know, I don't see how you can say that the Jim Crow era is gone or what was defeated. And I kept saying that, well, mm-hmm. as an historically specific regime and ensemble of enforced social relations, it was defeated. So, but mm-hmm. fewer and fewer people are capable of making that distinction even, which I think bodes ill for the Republic overall, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Who was the guy again?
It was...
That you were...
This was Jared Ball. I was on his podcast.
You said a nationalist?
Yeah, black nationalist.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. Yeah, I'm not familiar with that podcast, so that's interesting. Right. I was going to mention actually that, you know, well, I mean, going back to that conversation we were having about kids' mm-hmm. books, you know, a lot of the kids' books are about, you know, when you're talking about the civil rights era, there's books that are about like John mm-hmm. Lewis or, and what always frustrates me about those texts is the way that they don't talk about systems or movements, right. really, right. They, you know, or how sort of the whole thing right. works as a social phenomenon. It's more about kind of valorizing an individual. And then, you know, there's a lot of TV shows today. I don't know if you've ever heard of two television shows. One was called Lovecraft Country.
Oh, I watched it. Yeah.
And one was, did you? Yeah. I mean, do you feel like that show, does that show connect up in any way with what you're saying about how we consume these images of kind of the horror?
Oh, yes, it does. Right. Absolutely. And I mean, I watch like part of the curse of, you know, comes along with the, with, you know, doing the academic work that I've done over the years is that I feel I have to watch more of shit like that than I would ever do. But yeah, I thought that thing was a horror from, you know, from like beginning to end. And partly mm-hmm. because of the, in fact, it's not even a historicity, but it's like the sort of blend of historical account and fantasy. I mean, just in intellectual terms, like I have always been a radical historicist, right? Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. In my political theory mm-hmm. work, even. And I can't remember when this was. I think it may have been the late 80s or the beginning of the 90s. I noticed there was some TV series on that was set presumably in Arthurian times, which is already fantasy, but that's fine.
right.
But it was a musical, and in the middle of scenes, people would start singing Broadway tunes. And I never watched, you know, anything except the trailers, but I thought that one version of hell for me, right, would be to have to sit through that for all eternity. Mm-hmm. But so, I mean, there's, and look, I understand license and stuff, but it's funny, my son, who is a historian, and I had a conversation about Game of Thrones, and you know, I only watched a couple of episodes, and he, like I, had assumed that it was kind of broadly set on pre-medieval Britain, right? And it took me a couple of episodes to figure out that it wasn't. This was a board game or something, and all the countries were made up. But he told me that he checked in, thinking the same thing I was thinking, and he said, and then I saw the dragon land on this woman's shoulder, and I figured, okay, it's not for me, right? So, but I think that kind of stuff is especially in a context like Lovecraft Country, is especially insidious, right? At a moment in which probably the dominant stream in Black American political and cultural discourse now, and since it's a dominant among Black Americans, it's a dominant one like in the society, is that past and that there's no distinction between past and present. And if there's no, right? And ideologically, actually, right, I mean, this is what I've been, what I was trying to write about before our call this morning. But one of the things that premise does is an underwrite, this argument that nothing has changed, and Black Americans' lives are still determined by an abstract, always almost pornographic racism, as they supposedly had been in 1860, right? And that does political work that's basically also class skewed. But it's just like wrong understandings, right? I mean, it drives me batshit crazy.
That's interesting.
And so,
yeah.
So I'm also on that point. So one of my favorite popular films of all time is Glory, right? And I was surprised at the time to hear some Black people and people who understood themselves to be anti-racists, and mainly younger people, but complain that the film was a white savior story because the officers were white. And I said, well, but the film is based on an historical reality, and a Black regiment couldn't have had white officers, right, in 1863. So, but that's when I began to wonder, and my wondering bore full fruit in in the Black Panther film, right? My suspicion had been that what people want. Actually, I wrote about this like in a Baffler article. I can send you a link if you'd like. What people wanted.
I'd love to see it.
Wasn't any kind of honest accounting of Black American political history. What they wanted was inspirational stories, right? And in films like Glory and a few years ago, The Free State of Jones, the arguments that that those stories didn't express Black agency, while absurd on their face, really meant in the charges that Black people weren't in charge.
Say something cut out for a second. It really meant what? Say that again.
A complaint that Black people weren't running things, right? So that the officers weren't Black in the case of Glory, or that Newton Knight was a leader of this insurgency in Mississippi. So what Black agency means, right, is basically the Black CEO.
That's very interesting. The book made me think a lot about those representations beyond just you know, going into popular media and stuff. So I appreciate you.
Oh, cool. Well, thank you. I'm glad I did.
Talking about that. Yeah. Oh, definitely. Do you have a little bit more time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I know we're, it's noon. Mm-hmm. Are you okay? All right. Okay. Cause I have a couple more questions I wanted to ask you, and I'm going to move on to the
and
next
then at some point,
thing I wanted to ask you about.
I think at some point we should talk about Charleston.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And this actually is a perfect, this next question, mm-hmm. I think will be a great segue.
Oh, okay. Great.
Because I want to ask you about continuity versus change. And so in the book, you write about how you experienced the South as a middle-class Black person, both while the Jim Crow system was intact and after it was dismantled in the mid-1960s, going up to the present. And part of what you're trying to do, I think, is answer this question about continuity versus change. So in other words, how has the South changed since Jim Crow and how has it not changed? And we were just talking about that mm-hmm. a little bit. And where can we still see in the 21st century remnants of or echoes of that system? And what is the significance of, or how do we make sense of those remnants or echoes? Can you talk a little bit about grappling with this question, why that was an important question for you and how you ultimately answered it?
Sure.
And I think grounding mm-hmm. that, you know, certainly there's actually Charleston is a great case study for that, I think. And I know not everybody listening will be familiar with Charleston, but, you know.
Oh, no, I agree. Like I would
probably a lot of people.
Yeah, in fact, I was going to say, like, if I were to set out to find remnants, you know, any place in the old Confederacy, Charleston would be the place mm-hmm. I went first.
Right. Even as a New Orleanian, you would say.
Oh, no, totally, totally. I mean, to get into this, let me say this first, that about the continuity and change problem. One of the ways that I began to experience that problem, or like how to, or the need to navigate it, was through mm-hmm. Historical scholarship on Mississippi, ironically, that because mm-hmm. there was a handful of really good and interesting books. A couple of really, really good ones that came out on the Mississippi Delta region. Must have been mid 90s or late 80s, or between late 80s and mid 90s. Mm-hmm. One by Neil McMillan called Dark Journey, and another by James Cobb called The Most Southern Place on Earth. And what was really interesting mm-hmm. about them was that they were the among the first studies to weave the history of Blacks and of racial engagement, right? Into the history of the state, that had been done, and they were both very, very well done, very helpful, very smart. Mm-hmm. They both completely ran out of steam by the 1970s, because both had mm-hmm. had been so captured by the heroic narrative of civil rights struggle that they mm-hmm. didn't take account of, couldn't see the level of mundane inter elite Black and white politics being played out in sometimes or on the edges of the Democratic Party in places mm-hmm. like Jackson, the Gulf Coast, and elsewhere. So when the transition mm-hmm. came, they weren't equipped even to see how the new regime that took place sort of grew kind of organically from the edges of the old one, basically, right? Mm-hmm. So that's part of the problem. So at the core of it for me, it's like a political problem. And I've since written a really long study or paper of New Orleans of Black politics in New Orleans across the 20th century that tries to provide an account of this.
Mm-hmm. So how would you say, if you like take Charleston, for example, how would you talk about Charleston in that kind
sure.
of post-1965 era?
Well, one thing is, so when I first started going there, I remember one thing that stands out to me in particular, but there are many other instances, was mm-hmm. the marker on that house, I forget the address now, where Calhoun wrote the nullification of the ordinance. in the 70s
I'm trying to remember.
Purely congratulatory, right? I mean, this is where John C. Calhoun, great patriot, did this, that, and the other. By the time I was next down there to walk around, it was really like the mid to late 90s. And there was a much more historically accommodating marker on the house. And I've seen that around a lot of places there. So like there's in fact, I just wrote something about this in a chapter for a book.
I think it's called the Thomas B's House.
Yeah, that's it. I think that's it.
94 Church Street.
Yeah, that's right. That's it. Yep. Mm-hmm. So it's that kind of stuff.
But you said the sign that was there later. Mm-hmm. Can you say that again? That it was.
By the 90s, that sign, you know, the original sign had been replaced with something that acknowledged Calhoun's role as a defender of slavery, the place of the nullification ordinance in threatening the Union, right? But right, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And we saw more and more changes like that. I mean, not just in Charleston, but in many, many other places around the region.
So we're talking about how there are more acknowledgments to attach to some of these historical sites that of the role of those sites and the people that were associated with them in slavery, for example. And of course, you know, we probably don't have time to get into the whole monuments stuff that you go into the book, but it's related in that, you know, monuments are being taken down, which is a kind of acknowledgement that these things represent this really repugnant part of our history. But what, you know, I want to get at what that means to you, that's happening at this particular moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, as I've said in the book and every place else I can, like I hated that statuary my entire life.
The Beauregard.
Beauregard, Lee.
Statue in New Orleans.
All that stuff.
Calhoun
right,
and Charleston.
Exactly.
Right.
But, and I should say, so I'm happy that it's gone, right? And to me, the most impressive one of all was taking down the Calhoun statue from Marion Square. But it's not so much that the statuary is removed and the past, therefore, at least symbolically repudiated, but it's what about the past is repudiated. And as a parallel, right? But the parallel is race theories, right? So theories of inherent racial differences that play out into a hierarchy like of human worth and capacities appear, and egalitarians struggle against them. And so far, for the moment, they've been repudiated, but what often enough gets repudiated is the historically specific metaphor for or language of inequality, right? But the fundamental commitment, to naturalized inequality is like an ontological one, and there's something like that with the repudiations of white supremacy that accompany taking down the monuments and changing the street names and the like, because to the extent
or altering a historical plaque.
No, that's right. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right. Because usually, what's repudiated is bad ideas and bad practices from the past, not the social order that creates and then reproduces like intense inequalities, right? So in a way, getting rid of the monuments and applauding that can, without intention, can reaffirm the legitimacy of the contemporary expressions of inequality, which are often just as just as intense, but with a different cover story, basically. Right, right, than the racial ones were.
And so how does the role of race change in society when that happens? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you have these acknowledgments in all these different historical sites of this history that weren't there before. You have the taking down of the statues, you have taking down of the Confederate flag, at least officially. Mm-hmm. So what happens to the issue of race? What role is it playing?
I mean, South Carolina is an interesting case in that regard too. And I'll send you a little essay that my friend in Orangeburg and I wrote about this, that the way that the post-segregation era political regime has taken shape is that race is important now as it was then, but like in a different way. Both Democrats and Republicans in South Carolina, I think this is true like in every other state in the Confederacy and probably far beyond, you have an interest in maintaining race as a crucial fault line in politics. And from our work in South Carolina, like we've seen this especially up close and personal, that race on both sides like becomes a mechanism for making certain that no left of center politics gets off the ground, which is what it was, when V.O. Key wrote about South Carolina politics in 1949. Mm-hmm. But it's just that it's coming from a couple of directions now.
Right. And how does that, can you just give a concrete example of how that's operating right now?
I'd say one, what was like, during the Democratic primaries in South Carolina in both 2016 and 2020, James Clyburn, but he wasn't alone, right? I mean, John Lewis was part of this too, attacked Sanders, basically for not being the racially authentic candidate. I think it was Lewis who said snarkily once that he never saw Sanders at the civil rights movement, right? In the civil rights movement.
Yeah. That's correct.
But he noted that he did, he noted that he knew Bill and Hillary Clinton. And I said, yeah, well, if he saw Hillary at a civil rights demo, he would remember because she would have been the one wearing the Goldwater sign. Because she was a Goldwater supporter then.
Right. Ear to the Pavement is produced by me, Allison Lerish-Dean, in association with Progressive City. Our music is by Longman. Progressive City Radical Alternatives is an online publication dedicated to ideas and practices that advance racial, economic, and social justice in cities. We feature stories on inclusive urban planning practices, grassroots organizing, and civic action. Visit Progressive City at progressivecity.net, where you'll find other episodes of Ear to the Pavement, as well as articles. Follow me on Twitter at Ear to the Pavement. That's EAR followed by the number 2 and then the pavement. Follow Progressive City on Twitter and Facebook at PCityRadical.